Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll speak with Nadeem Mazen, Massachusetts' first Muslim city councilor, about a new effort to recruit and support Muslim Americans running for public office. And then we'll be joined by Sarah Posner, a reporter for the Investigative Fund, about a number of issues on her beat, which is the nexus between religion and politics. First, a couple of items you may have missed this week. Trump Spock's Sean Spicer, whom I have dubbed Beltway Bob, was outraged, I tell you, about reporters referring to Trump's executive order as a Muslim ban. He's technically right, of course. It was, in fact, a sloppily drafted attempt to fulfill his year-long promise to ban Muslims. The problem is that Spicer himself referred to it as a ban the day earlier, and his boss was calling it a ban on Twitter as late as Saturday. Again, this is the gang that can't shoot straight. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times reports that Trump's inner circle sees the ban as just a starting point. Brian Bennett and Noah Bierman report, and I quote, "Their ultimate goal is far broader. Trump's top advisors on immigration, including chief strategist Steve Bannon and senior advisor Stephen Miller," who, by the way, is a total piece of work, "see themselves as launching a radical experiment to fundamentally transform how the U.S. decides who is allowed into the country and to block a generation of people who, in their view, won't assimilate into American society." This is a total red herring. The patterns of assimilation are very consistent. You get the first generation, they can't really speak English, they stay, they adhere closely to the norms of the old country. Second generation, they're English is, they speak English as natives. The language that they spoke, the country of origin, gets a little rough. Third generation, they have a hard time communicating with grandma and are fully assimilated. Another report suggested that the administration, the regime, was considering going after legal green card holders who receive government benefits. I find this refreshing in the sense that I'm sick of xenophobes saying that they welcome legal immigrants and only care about illegal immigration. We know that's not true because they freak out every time someone flies a Mexican flag or speaks Spanish. But so I give them points for honesty here. The ban was broader than most people think, and Danny Vinnick reported for Politico that one little notice provision might just destroy the American tourism industry. If they pursue it, and I say if because they've bandied about a lot of ideas that they then abandoned, it would require all entrants to the U.S., that is, tourists, students, whatever, to go through a screening process that might include disclosing what websites they'd visited, because we need to know what online porn they're checking out, and reviewing their social media posts. You can forget travelers coming to the U.S. if we start down that road. And I think that's part of a broader pattern with this thing. You know, his primary pitch to the American people is that we're governed by idiots whose moves are hurting the economy. They're letting our competitors trample all over us. And that's exactly what's going on right now. We're governed by idiots who don't seem to understand that we benefit a great deal by attracting a lot of smart people from all over the world. We benefit a great deal by attracting a lot of foreign investment. If this policy continues, we can not only say goodbye to tourists, but also those foreign investors and engineers and technicians and all sorts of people who can just as easily apply their talents elsewhere. And if these morons bumble us into a trade war, which seems increasingly likely, we're really going to feel the pain of being governed by real idiots. And on that happy note, let's take a break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Nadeem Mazen.
I keep hearing you're concerned about my happiness, but all that thought you're giving me is conscience, I guess. If I were walking in your shoes, I wouldn't worry none. Are you and your friends are worried about me? I'm having lots of fun. Counting flowers on the wall, that don't bother me at all. Playing solitaire till dawn with the deck of 51. Smoking cigarettes and watching Captain Kangaroo. I don't tell me. I've nothing to do. Last night I dressed in tails, pretended I was on the town. As long as I can dream, it's hard to slow the swinger down. So please don't give a thought to me, I'm really doing fine. You can always find me here and having quite a time. Counting flowers on the wall, that don't bother me at all. Playing solitaire till dawn with the deck of 51. Smoking cigarettes and watching Captain Kangaroo. Now don't tell me I've nothing to do. It's good to see you, I must go. I know I look a fright. Anyway, my eyes are not accustomed to this light, and my shoes are not accustomed to this hard concrete. So I must go back to my room and make my day complete. Counting flowers on the wall, that don't bother me at all. Playing solitaire till dawn with the deck of 51. Smoking cigarettes and watching Captain Kangaroo. Now don't tell me I've nothing to do. Don't tell me I've nothing to do.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm happy to be joined by Nadeem Mohsen. I first met Nadeem when I was covering the Occupy movement, and he went on to run for office. He became the first Muslim American elected to the Cambridge, Massachusetts City Council, and he and a couple of colleagues launched an organization called Jetpack Inc., which in turn issued a challenge this week for American Muslims to follow suit and run for office themselves. Nadeem, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for taking the time. I've written a bit about the politics of the Muslim American community. This is a group that tends to be pretty engaged in their communities, but they vote at lower rates than the population as a whole. They don't, or they haven't historically participated in electoral politics to the same degree that they have involved themselves in their own communities. Do you have a sense of why that is?
You know, I think for a long time, Muslims have been reacted, I think, to the narrative set for us by the journalistic right and the alt-right. And, you know, I think a lot of American Muslims just thought that they were operating in good faith, reacting and responding and setting people straight. But lo and behold, we know now that Breitbart and others and the journalists in general are willing to propagate something because it's entertaining, not necessarily because it's true. I think yes. that American Muslims are taking the narrative back and are also getting more proactive in community leadership. Of course, as you said, American Muslims have always been engaged, have always been in service roles, believe that it is a religious mandate to help neighbors, to help community. But to actually take positions in political leadership, I think it's something that my generation and younger are doing in a much higher volume.
Do you sense a shift in Muslim Americans' sense of their position in this country after George W. Bush and going into Obama's administration and now with the rise of Trumpism? How are Muslim Americans responding to that? And I mentioned Bush because the one thing, I'm not a George W. Bush fan, but the one thing that I give him credit for is he was, you know, immediately after 9/11, he visited a mosque in Washington, D.C., and he said again and again that Islam is a religion of peace. You know, he really emphasized this point. How is the rise of Trumpism impacting this community?
You know, I think fortunately for most or all of us, the rise of Trumpism, the rise of Trumpism is confined to a very small part of the Republican right. And when we look at and talk about the anti-American, anti-patriotic approach that Trump is taking to limit our constitutional rights, to limit the rights of all Americans, to use Muslims as scapegoats and as a front for the power grab that he wants to make, to use this conflict as a distraction from the way that he is eroding basic precepts of our democracy, including conflict of interest at his level, and including essentially being bought by a lot of foreign interests. I think people on the right and the left are dismayed by this. They want to see a Democratic Party that is strong and that harks to American values, where it may have abandoned those values in the past. People want to see a Republican Party that is ethical and that is not winning at all costs and is certainly not subverting the basis of our economic primacy, our educational investments. Thankfully, I think that this will allow us to become less polarized and hopefully come together in the future. But it's going to take a lot of dialogue, and certainly it's going to take this kind of slow roll of Republicans getting fed up with what the party is doing now.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about your organization, Jetpack, and this new campaign that you launched this week.
Jetpack trains American Muslims, minority allies, and to a great extent, anyone who want to organize in their communities, who want to learn how to connect with people and the issues at play in the community, and then who want to use those skills to go on one day and run for office. The trainings are taking place at the high school level as an AP-accredited U.S. Government and History course with a hands-on civic engagement and organizing component, and young professionals, as well as older professionals, are also coming on for kind of remote training in a less curricular, a little bit more flexible basis, and just getting jogged along several recipes and several modules of personal practice, where reaching out to the community, learning by doing, organizing, and then eventually kind of graduating from the program and being able to go on and run for office is made much easier.
There are various organizations, including obviously the two-party state operations, that offer, you know, training and support for people who want to get into electoral politics. What is the niche that you hope to fill, or the piece of the existing infrastructure that you think is missing?
Sure. You know, I think to a great extent, and I'm on the Democratic State Committee in Massachusetts, and I've just been appointed as an affirmative action outreach chair, co-chair. I can say with great love about my own party that there's no relationship between people and their parties in 2017, that people, for the most part, both on the left and the right, are feeling very far away from the principles of their party, and are wanting to come back and wanting to see themselves reflected in their parties. I think this gives people an opportunity to say, I do care deeply about my community, local and state. I do care about my federal politics, but I can make a huge impact here, closer to home. And I need some very, very specific skills. And then I need to have an impact on those existing institutions rather than them kind of forming and construing my work. I think people want to get involved and have some kind of autonomy. I think people find it very natural and very comfortable to start at the local level or at the hyper local level in their neighborhoods and local communities. And I think to a very great extent, it's because both the Democratic and the Republican Party have left so many behind that folks want to come out and get trained and start making a difference.
Now, your nonprofit status and your mission statement is that you're looking to train people regardless of their ideological positioning, regardless of the party that they feel closer to. This has been an issue that has come up with some other organizations that serve underserved communities. Emily's List comes to mind. They've taken a lot of heat for endorsing Republicans. Given that, even though a liberal Republican may be pro-choice, for example, they're still voting, at the federal level, obviously, they're still going to end up voting for Speaker Ryan as opposed to Speaker Pelosi. Although I think it's fair to say that The left is not untainted by Islamophobia. There is quite a significant difference between the two parties when it comes to their respect for Islam, their respect for religious diversity or lack thereof. Have you wrangled with this issue?
You know, the two parties have been in flux. I would say we can very reasonably say that most Americans wouldn't want a Speaker Pelosi or a Speaker Ryan. And I think that's really important to come to terms with. We do not have a set of popular, productive, collaborative politicians on the left or on the right within the party.
But Nadeem, what I'm saying is that a Speaker yeah. Pelosi is yep. not going to look favorably on a ham-fisted ban of refugees from seven Muslim-majority countries, just to give a very obvious example that's in the news
Speaker Ryan
is very positive about this.
I understand what you're saying. My point is that if the Republican and Democratic parties were to have more participation, the actual people in positions of power would not seek an unconstitutional ban, whether they were on the right or whether they were on the left. My point is that Muslims and nonprofits who train them are welcome to and probably required to train people on both sides of the aisle. But this shouldn't be seen as some kind of defect or some kind of drawback. It's a great idea to have more representation and less callous treatment on both sides of the aisle. And I would say that if the bulk of Americans were represented, not just American Muslims, but Americans were represented, that neither the Republican Party nor the Democratic Party would have these minority and majority leaders in the seats that they're in, and that that people would feel that their liberties and that their constitution was much more protected and much more supported.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Nadeem Hassan about his new project to recruit Muslims to run for office on the local level, et cetera, et cetera. Nadeem, I was Googling around to prep for this interview, and I stumbled across a Breitbart piece about your re-election in 2015. And listeners should know that Nadeem won his seat in 2013 by this razor-thin margin, then went on to win re-election by a very large margin in 2015. Anyway, I came across this Breitbart piece titled "Hamas on the Charles, Cambridge, Mass. Re-elects care leader to city council." It starts out saying that you appear to be a model citizen, but are really a Muslim Brotherhood plant. And this is 100% standard operating procedure for the right. CARE has been accused of terrorism constantly. It's just, this is part and parcel of being a Muslim in the public sphere. My question is, do you offer aspiring candidates any kind of, I don't know, specialized preparation for running for office in a climate that is often hostile towards Islam?
Great question. You know, just to go back to that article first, you know, I feel very supported here in this community. People know my work. They know it's about affordable housing and education and inclusion and community engagement. And so when this came out, both my allies and my political opponents said, hey, this is not okay. This is not true. This is not what's happening. I think that's going to be the case for a lot of leaders. They come up in their community. If they are authentic community organizers, they will have the support they need. I think it's probably wrong for people to run for office without having ties to the community just to get their name out there or just because they can shake enough hands. I think it's important for people to actually organize, analyze, and mobilize in their communities. And in so doing, I think American Muslims will be insulated from this type of targeting. But just to give you a sense of how ubiquitous it is, every American Muslim leader at this level gets targeted. Once you get into local elected office, once you head a college club like the Muslim Students Association, once you join a nonprofit board or raise a certain amount of money for you know, someone that the alt-right doesn't like, let's say the white supremacist right in this case, given the tone of that article. We see this across the board. That means tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people facing this targeting, just as a matter of course. At this point, so transparently and nakedly bigoted, and so has strayed so far from anything that is factual or anything that is fair, then I actually think Americans are turning away from this kind of state of affairs, turning away from not just the right-wing media, but from the general media when it seeks to paint, international conflict, it seeks to paint domestic issues as a source of entertainment. I think a lot of Americans are now suddenly very hungry for what's really going on, and Americans on both the right and the left are realizing, oh my goodness, there's been a huge volume of villainization of Muslims, and scapegoating Muslims or vilifying Muslims isn't going to solve the real problems. And so, both Republicans and Democrats are saying in very large numbers, we need to have a real conversation about what's going to improve our economic primacy, our educational outcomes, and actually secure the future of this country. And there's very, very few people who would argue that the conversations about Muslims today are ones that are improving the country, improving our safety, etc.
I would think that this would be kind of a burden. You know, if you're a Christian, if you're a Jew, if you're whatever, you can run for office on a platform, a policy platform, and just be a public official who happens to be Christian or Jewish. And it seems to me, I saw this another piece about you in the Boston Globe, and it kind of said that you would prefer to be talking about bread and butter issues, affordable housing and the minimum wage, but you felt kind of compelled to talk about your faith. This was after the San Bernardino massacre.
Mm-hmm.
It's obvious that Muslims have to answer for every bad act any Muslim commits anywhere in the world in a way that Christians and Jews don't. Do you think this is kind of a subtle barrier to entry in that there are people who would like to serve their community and just be public servants and don't want to be spokespeople for the entire Muslim world?
It's a double-edged sword, I'd say. On one hand, I think every single one of us who reaches a certain level of leadership, as I said, gets targeted. It's across the board. It means that you have to spend time resetting the narrative. You have to spend time correcting the record. You have to spend time, reassuring people and building your base of support, both emotionally, because it's not great to be attacked or get death threats, and socially, so that you have a base in your community willing to correct the record. And for me, that happened spontaneously. People came to my aid and did all that without being asked. The other side of that is once you have that support base, you are really in a place that I would hope any organizer, any leader could aspire to get to, one where we are supporting one another, where we are correcting the record, where we're doing important work in our community, and where we're gathering to protect one another from libel, slander, and harm. That's something I think any leader could use, and especially leaders who have been in office for a very long time and don't have anyone telling them, hey, you've strayed from the course here, or, we support you when you do good work here, but not when you do, politicization of important local issues there. To have a community of support and of political and engagement discourse is, I think, one of the main goals of our democratic and political system, and it has kind of been missing as our civic infrastructure has eroded that positivity and that type of both critique and support, I think has eroded with it, leaving politicians as kind of judges to sit and make decisions with very little accountability and very little support.
Interesting. All right, before I let you go, so you've launched this new project. Have you seen, put it in the context of the larger organizing efforts within the Muslim community, are you seeing a lot of new efforts to kind of get American Muslims together to act in concert in the age of Trump?
That's a great question. I would just look to our local Boston scene, where 10 years ago, I think the people leading a struggle were from a totally different generation. And now, when I say the struggle, I mean, all of us get targeted. All of us get, kind of put up as some kind of negative influence by the alt-right, by the white supremacist right. And those who are leading now aren't struggling. They are of a different generation. They are very proactive and cooperative. We have Shannon Irwin of the Muslim Justice League. We have Yusuf Evalli leading one of the largest, actually, mosque in New England, ISBCC, here in Roxbury. We have John Robbins, the executive director of CARE. We're all in the same city, all roughly the same age range. We are not on the defensive. We are doing good work every day, 95% of the day, 5% responding to, you know, ridiculous outrages.
Slanders.
And you can imagine that that's happening all over the country, that folks are on WhatsApp groups, Facebook groups, together. And, you know, actually, I think it would be delightful to have, you know, a couple of Republican observers or a couple of Democratic Party observers on these lists and in these groups. They'd be astonished at how much these groups sound like their groups. You know, who's going to get the food, and how are we going to, you know, teach the newcomers the old, you know, kind of strategy for conciliatory behavior on the list? Or it's just very mundane stuff about how to run a group, how to grow a group, and how to collaborate in an age where we're all so, so busy, and it's difficult to, you know, to get on the same page, get aligned, and get done with our homework as a collective. Certainly, you're right, that's happening. But it's an uphill battle, I think, for any group of organizers to say, I'm going to put down my own organization's work and I'm going to pick up the mantle of a more organized, more aligned, more collaborative spirit. And we're just getting there. I think as American Muslim leaders, and I can't speak for all of them, there's so many, we're starting to get past that threshold, and it's very exciting, but it's still a work in progress.
Nadeem Mazen, how can people support your project?
Well, thanks for asking. People can go to JET-PAC.com. They can forward folks who they think might want to run for office. We're looking for American Muslims to get trained and then go on to run for office. They can also donate on that page. Folks can go to Facebook.com/JETPACINC, JETPACINC, and like and follow our work. We hope that people get in touch when they're following our work. We love to chat with people who have input, who have support, who have ideas, and obviously who have a network of people who want to learn and want to run.
I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back.
When the little blue bird who has never said a word starts to sing, let's fall in love. Hope they've got plans, kids, they wish to it. Even lazy jellyfish do it, let's fall in love. I've heard that lizards and frogs do it, lying on a rock. They say that roosters do it, with a doodle and cock. Some Argentines without beans do it, I read a moss and beans. Let's do it, let's fall in love. All the chimpanzees in the zoo do it. Some courageous kangaroos do it, let's fall in love. I'm sure sometimes on the sly you do it.
Maybe. Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I am still Joshua Holland. My next guest is an old friend and colleague of mine who happens to be one of the best reporters in the country on the religion and politics beat. Sarah Posner is a reporter with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Her work has also appeared in Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, The Nation, elsewhere, everywhere. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we're 2 weeks in. Did you ever imagine a new administration could cause so much chaos in such a short time? It's actually pretty impressive in a bizarro world kind of way, isn't it?
It is. It definitely is. I think even those of us who anticipated that Trump's MO would be disruption and chaos could not anticipate that it was going to be as bad as it is.
And do you think he's just flooding the zone in an attempt to overwhelm our ability to react to things?
Yes. Actually, I think President Bannon is doing that, but...
Okay. Now, Trump has the lowest approval rating of any president in the history of modern polling, but according to CNN's latest poll, which was released on Saturday, there are stark partisan differences. This is always the case, but 90% of Republicans still have a favorable view of the president. Democrats, of course, are terrified. And the reason he's polling so badly overall is that self-identified independents have really swung against him. During the election, you wrote a number of really important pieces, important explanatory pieces on why evangelicals had flocked to a blasphemous, foul-mouthed, often divorced reality TV star. I know it's too soon to say, but do you see that support remaining strong? And how do you think they're processing stuff like Trump's Muslim ban? Because I can see that going both ways. You know, turning away refugees isn't very Christian, but then again, Muslims, right?
Well, I don't see Trump's support from the religious right, the same religious right that supported him during the campaign. I do not see that eroding at all. They were thrilled with his signing of an executive order reinstating and expanding the global gag rule, which prohibits federally funded NGOs across the world from mentioning abortion, referring people for abortion, even telling people that abortion exists. They were thrilled with that. They were very thrilled with the nomination of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court to fill Antonin Scalia's seat. They're thrilled with many of his cabinet appointees, Betsy DeVos, Tom Price, Jeff Sessions, Ben Carson. So he has pretty much by and large made them happy. Now, there is a wing of the white evangelical world that's more involved in sort of missionary kind of work where they may be involved in resettling refugees. They may be more in favor of immigration reform. And many of them are alarmed by his immigration and refugee and Muslim ban executive orders. But I would say that in comparison to the way evangelicals pressure politicians on issues like LGBT rights and abortion, their objections to those executive orders have been rather tepid in comparison, but they have raised objections. But for the religious right, the really hardcore religious right that really got behind Trump during the campaign, so I'm talking about people like Tony Perkins or Jerry Falwell, and not the sort of less strident evangelicals who may have been opposed to him because of his mainly his immigration views, that latter group is a small constituency. I don't see any erosion of his support among these religious right leaders. It's only going to grow. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, that he's willing to do things like appoint Jerry Falwell to lead some commission on higher education, his pledge at the National Prayer Breakfast this week to completely destroy the Johnson Amendment, which is the part of the Internal Revenue Code that prohibits tax-exempt organizations, including houses of worship, from politicking. Now, it doesn't prevent them from exercising their First Amendment rights, as the religious right often likes to claim. It just makes their tax exemption contingent on them not politicking. So that's meant to prevent tax-exempt dollars, you know, basically the taxpayer subsidizing pastors and other clergy from using those tax-exempt status to endorse political candidates. But he has vowed to get rid of that, which I think would not be possible legally via executive order. But shortly after he pledged to, or right around the same time he pledged this week to do it, members of the Congressional Prayer Caucus in the House introduced legislation to repeal the Johnson Amendment, which obviously, you know, if Trump doesn't try to get rid of it via executive order, he will sign legislation that Congress passes to do that.
Now, but he can't get rid of it by executive order.
Well, he could try.
A law passed in 1954.
Right. It's part of the Internal Revenue Code. So it, you know, in reality, but the reality of the Johnson Amendment is this, it's that the IRS enforces it, right? So it is, you know, he could conceivably signal to his Internal Revenue Commissioner that he didn't want it enforced. And, you know, in reality, it was never enforced under Obama. There were no revocations of tax exempt status under Obama. But the reality is, even if the statute, that part of the statute was not repealed, you know, it's pretty much up to an individual administration about whether to actually enforce it or not. So, you know, getting rid of it or not, you know, might not make all that much of a difference, but they might want to get rid of it for future presidents.
Yeah, that was my sense, is that the law is almost never enforced. Was there a time when it was aggressively enforced?
It was never really aggressively enforced. It was enforced a few times. And there were a couple of times where it was enforced against liberal churches, or one instance where it was enforced against a liberal church. And then there was a church that had its tax exempt status revoked in the 90s for opposing Bill Clinton's presidential candidacy. But it's very rarely enforced, and because, you know, there is, the churches are allowed to engage in political advocacy. Like, so for example, a pastor can say from the pulpit, abortion is wrong, but they can't say, don't vote for the candidate candidate because they support abortion, right? So, but sometimes that line is a little fuzzy. So, but yes. Also the rules about when they should instigate an investigation have always been a little muddled, and, you know, so it's very rarely enforced is the bottom line.
And in the, as a general statement, in the aftermath of the brouhaha, the mostly contrived pseudo scandal about the IRS targeting conservative nonprofits, my understanding is that the IRS is extremely hesitant to get involved in anything that could possibly be painted as politically motivated.
Right.
So I'm, you right. know, I mean, this is one of those things.
That's one of the issues with it, obviously, right? Because the IRS would always run the risk of an action being portrayed as, oh, well, you're only going after that church because that church opposed the sitting president that you serve. So,
right. And it's religious persecution. And you have this large number of Americans who think that they're constantly being oppressed. Now, Pew estimates that the Muslim American population is projected to double in the next 30 years. It's going to reach just over 2%. That'll be about 50% higher than the Jewish share of the population. I wonder if the specter of imams engaging in electioneering from the pulpit might have the same effect on the religious rights view of this issue as armed Black Panthers marching on Sacramento did for Reagan's view of gun control. But that may be asking for too much logic.
I haven't heard that at all. From the religious right, all I've heard is this issue being framed as a question of free expression for pastors. And I haven't even heard them discuss it in the context of clergy from other religions.
They're not big into consequentialist.
Can I add a bit of history here too, though?
Please, by all means.
Is that, you know, part of the origin story of the religious right is that they believed that it was government oppression of, or a government attempt at suppression of religious liberty when the IRS revoked the tax-exempt status of Bob Jones University in the 1970s. And the IRS revoked Bob Jones University's tax-exempt status because they they had a ban on interracial dating on campus, and that was the reason for the revocation. But the religious right framed it as, well, that was based on a religious belief, and so the IRS cannot be getting involved in, you know, monitoring or judging somebody's religious views. And so that is very much sort of embedded in the origin story and the way the religious right sees the IRS and its power to, or in this case, probably lack of power, to revoke the tax-exempt status of Christian organizations. So I think that history kind of looms in the mind of some people in the religious right.
Okay, good. Interesting background. Let's switch gears a little bit. You had a big scoop this week, and congrats for that. You got your hands on a preliminary draft of an executive order that would have made it easier to discriminate against LGBT Americans. Now, Trump is a whirling dervish, and it appears that things have changed since your report, which came out this week in The Nation. We'll get to that, but let's start with the draft, EO. What would it do?
It would do a lot of things. To me, when this document came into my hands, it looked to me like basically a laundry list of a religious right wish list on the issues that they frame as religious liberty or religious freedom. There's a provision in it to repeal the Johnson Amendment, for example. It would also define religious freedom as and religious liberty as encompassing any area of life, you know, so just not just at church, at work, right? So like it would blow open this enormous religious exemption so that people at work, and this would also include federal workers, federal contractors, federal grantees, to say my religious beliefs prevent me from serving this client or customer or beneficiary of this social services because they're involved in a same-sex non-married relationship. Opposite sex, you know, a straight non-married relationship. They live with somebody, but they're not married to them. Or they've had an abortion.
Right.
Or they're trans. Or they're a lesbian. Or, you know, the list, the potential list goes on and on. It was just like the broadest possible opening for people to say in virtually every area of life, at work, at their place of business, et cetera, I'm not going to serve you because I have a religious or even moral objection. So they wouldn't even have to root it in some known religious theology. It could just be a moral objection. So it was incredibly broad. And, you know, would pretty much open up, you know, federal contractors who provide social services to, you know, foster kids to say, you know, that they wouldn't serve a kid or acknowledge that they were trans or refer them to another provider that would be more better equipped to serve this trans child. It could include a Social Security Administration worker in a regional office who might say to somebody, you're in a same-sex marriage and I have a religious objection to processing your Social Security benefits. You know, so it would be incredibly broad. And I would add as well that it's similar to a state law that was passed in Mississippi last year and struck down by a federal court as unconstitutional in violation of the Establishment Clause for favoring one religious belief, one set of religious beliefs over another. So, you know, it would probably, if Trump were to sign this or some version of it, it would probably immediately be subject to a court challenge.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that came up this week with the so-called Muslim ban is that it was, in addition to being morally depraved, it was sloppily drafted to the point where the challenge almost wrote itself. I believe that we should have something like an Amish bus driver test for all of these conscious issues. Like, you know, the Amish don't believe in modernity. They don't drive motor vehicles, and that's great. I respect their belief. I find their, you know, buggies adorable, right?
Great for but you don't tourists. Have to. Don't have to find their buggies adorable in order to want to protect their constitutional right to drive in the buggy.
No, I totally mm-hmm. respect their constitutional mm-hmm. right to believe that cars are that you should drive in a horse-driven buggy, but nobody would suggest that we should respect an Amish bus driver who takes a job as a bus driver, refusing to drive the bus. And so it comes down to, you know, if your job is, if you're a pharmacist, you have one job, fill people's prescriptions.
Right.
Right? So if you say, oh, I have a religious objection to filling people's prescriptions, you shouldn't be a pharmacist any more than an Amish buggy driver should be a bus driver.
Well, that's exactly right. And in this case, as this executive order, if signed, would apply to federal contractors and grantees. So many, many religious organizations get federal funding to provide social services to vulnerable populations. And so not only would it be these social service or faith-based social service organizations potentially denying service to clients or beneficiaries on the basis of religious objections, it would be also that the taxpayers would be subsidizing that discrimination. So it's problematic on many levels.
All right. So we have this story. I think you published your story on Wednesday night. So on Friday, the White House releases a statement saying that Donald Trump loves the gays and will continue Obama's executive order on federal contractors. Now, I paraphrase. It didn't say Donald Trump loves the gays. I made that
right
up. But Politico reports, and I quote, members of the religious right with ties to the Trump administration said they have been led to believe that some changes will still be forthcoming, end quote. The story goes on to quote Tony Perkins. He said he'd been in touch with members of the administration, which I read as like Mike Pence, and was led to believe they'd do something to make gays and lesbians second-class citizens, despite backtracking on the draft EO that you revealed this week. Maybe this shows a rift between the Ivanka and Jared Kushner faction and Mike Pence. Maybe not, but that's how the story portrayed it. Do you have any insight as to what's going on behind the scenes, or would you like to offer some informed speculation?
Well, I think it's possible that Jared and Ivanka, Trump's daughter and son-in-law, who are said to be more socially liberal on LGBT issues, influenced him in some way on the specific thing that he issued the statement about, which was Obama's executive order protecting the from employment discrimination, the LGBT employees of federal contractors and federal agencies. Okay, that's a very small piece of this executive order. So if that's all they cared about, if the only thing that they cared about was to make sure that LGBT employees of federal contractors and federal agencies did not suffer employment discrimination, well, Trump signaled that that was something that he agreed with. However, this executive order would enact many other aspects of the religious rights laundry list of what they call religious freedom or religious exemptions that are a lot more complicated to understand than simply, this federal agency or this federal contractor can't fire this lesbian employee on the basis of her sexual orientation. It's much more complicated because you have these layers of things that are happening. So you have a faith-based faith-based grantee at the Department of Health and Human Services, whose job it is to provide, some kind of social service to vulnerable children, and they object to providing that service to trans children, for example. So, you know, and then the question becomes, okay, what happens to that child? Does that child stay, you know, does that religious objection mean that that child has to stay under the care of that faith-based social services agency and suffer whatever consequences? Does it mean that the agency, that the NGO does not have to refer that child to another provider that would, treat that child with the proper care? There are so many possible permutations of these big religious exemptions sought in the rest of the provisions of the executive order that the question of the employment discrimination by federal contractors and agencies is just the tip of the iceberg. So I feel like that a lot of that is getting eclipsed because, you know, basically what they're looking for too is that the executive order also defines a religious organization as including closely held corporations. So this is an attempt to expand the Supreme Court's decision in Hobby Lobby, which basically said that a closely held corporation could raise a religious objection to providing the contraception coverage under the Affordable Care Act to its employees. Well, this executive order attempts to expand that kind of possible religious exemption for closely held corporations like Hobby Lobby to other potential objections to federal law that they're required to comply with. So this executive order is so broad and sweeping and covers so many different areas and so much ground that these that this news coverage focusing on Ivanka and Jared's objection to this employment discrimination piece of it is, I think, missing the entire boat. And so when you hear Tony Perkins saying, well, I think he's still going to sign some version of this or pieces of it, maybe, you know, not in all in the same executive order, I think that what they're counting on is maybe he'll throw a bone to Ivanka and Jared if it is indeed their objection, by keeping in place Obama's executive order on the employment discrimination, but possibly opening up these other areas to allow organizations, closely held corporations, individuals to claim a religious conscience objection to a wide variety of things.
And Nate Silver snarked on Twitter, call me cynical, but seems very likely that sources portraying Jared and Ivanka in a heroic light are actually Jared and Ivanka.
Well, that's also possible, right? And, you know, that raises a question in this time of, you know, granting anonymity to White House sources to help us understand what's happening within the White House. But that's probably a topic for another day.
Yeah. Although, you know what? There's been a lot of leaks that have been informative and helpful, I think. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Sarah Posner. One more from the religion and politics beat. This appears to be a case of the dog catching a bus. Republicans have long vowed to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. It's been in their platform. So here comes Trump, and he promises to finally fulfill that promise. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is on board. How is Israel's security community reacting?
Well, the as much as the far right in Israel and right wing Jewish community in the United States and their right wing evangelical allies often use this as a talking point that we must, you know, make Israel the undivided capital of Israel. I mean, make Jerusalem the undivided capital of Israel and move the embassy there. In reality, the Israeli security apparatus is very concerned about security issues. Should that happen, it could be very inflammatory and incite violence. And who knows where that might lead. And so in reality, the security establishment in Israel does not want the embassy moved. So Trump made these blasé promises over the course of the campaign. And I'll say that in addition to the issues that we were talking about earlier in the show, the religious right also, the Christian right also very much favors this idea of moving the embassy. It's troubling that we don't know how seriously Trump takes the security concerns versus, you know, what his close advisors are telling him. I mean, obviously, his nominee to be the ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, is an outspoken advocate of moving the embassy. And so this is what Trump has been signaling for some months now, that this is what he would do, because I think he heard it as a talking point that his base wanted to hear. Now he's bumping up against these security concerns, but it's unknown, I think, because much of what Trump actually thinks and what his impulses are unpredictable, what he truly believes in this case, his promises that he's made to his base, or whether he's going to listen to voices of reason about whether to move the embassy.
It's amazing. And it really is ideology running smack dab into the brick wall of reality. BuzzFeed had a piece this week, and they interviewed an anonymous intelligence officer, Israeli intelligence officer, saying that it's basically symbolic. It gains Israel very little, but it will inflame not only the Palestinians, but really the entire Middle East, or it risks inflaming not only Palestinians, but the entire Middle East, and ending in, quote, unnecessary violence. According to that officer, the Israeli intelligence community has communicated this to their counterparts in the American security establishment. Sarah, what's the background here from an evangelical perspective? Would moving our embassy to Jerusalem merely like codify the facts on the ground and endorse the Israeli rights and the American Jewish rights view of Jerusalem as its undivided capital? Or is this one of these things that's supposed to usher in the rapture or something?
Well, I think that for a lot of rank and file evangelicals who are very, very pro-Israel, quote unquote, they don't have a sophisticated understanding really of a lot of these security issues. They see it more from an ideological perspective that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, so our embassy should be there and it should be fully in Jewish control, not in the control of anyone else. And for some of them, it does have to do with the ingathering of Jews that's necessary, you know, that will happen before the second coming. But I think that the real politique for evangelicals who do understand the actual facts on the ground part of it is that they are, in fact, opposed to the two-state solution. You know, these are, you know, I'm talking about Christian Zionists, not evangelicals who aren't Christian Zionists, and they are opposed to a two-state solution. So anything that would point in the direction of not having a two-state solution, which obviously moving the embassy would, because it's basically saying it's making a strong statement that Jerusalem is the capital, the undivided capital of Israel. And when they use that phrase, undivided capital, they mean no part of it, you know, not East Jerusalem, would be the capital of a future Palestinian state. So it's a clear statement of we don't want a two-state solution, and we want to undermine the two-state solution.
And listeners should understand that in all of the, you know, roadmaps and blueprints for peace, the two-state solution, the Geneva protocols or whatever it's called, in all of these proposals from the international community, from various American presidents, all the two-state solution proposals see Jerusalem as ultimately being administered internationally or cooperatively between Palestinians and Israelis. And it is one of those things that makes perfect sense. You have this little chunk of ground that happens to hold some of the most hallowed ground for both of the world's largest religions, Christianity and Islam, of course.
And Judaism.
And a relatively minor religion, right? And it seems like one thing that I always think is that if conservative evangelical Christians had any idea that there are constantly acts of religious discrimination and violence against Christians by militant Jews in the Old City, I have to think that they would feel differently about this. I mean, it's like they don't know, because I guess Fox would never report it or wherever they get their information. They don't know that priests get spit on and Christian churches get vandalized. And, you know, this is one of these things where it makes sense for the international community to say this should be ultimately, because of its importance to so many people around the world, this should ultimately be a shared city, shared by the great faiths.
Well, that's it's an aspiration, but
yeah. Anyway, Sarah Posner, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
I'd also like to thank Nadim Mazen. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can also send an email complaining about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you find it. I'd like to thank Digby at Hullabaloo, Crooks and Liars, and the Smirking Trump for letting me host the show at their joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. Play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. Your mother, she's an heiress, owns a block in St. John's Wood.